with capital pi, and I was incorrectly saying that pi can be obtained from the trace of a particular expression. It is true that pi is related to sigma, but the relation was not given, so this is the relation. So if you would have used yesterday's relation, you would have got 0, pi equal to 0, because the equation was traceless. Okay? So now what we want to do quickly is to outline to you how one obtains the last equation, which we didn't do yesterday, which comes from kappa dot, the trace of the evolution of the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Okay? So what I'm going to do is, for simplicity, I'm going to work with zero shear gauge, and I'm going to derive the equation in the gauge invariant variables, so everything will be fine. So if you work with a zero shear gauge, then chi is zero. And then from the definition of kappa, which we have, we just get minus, kappa is minus 3 phi dot the n naught plus 3 h alpha. There was a delta chi here, which is zero because we are in a zero shear gauge. So let us put n naught equal to 1. And let us also recall that in the zero shear gauge, the bodying potential phi h is phi, and in the standard notation, this is minus of psi, right? This is the Mukhanov notation, and similarly, the bodying's other potential phi a is just alpha in the zero shear gauge, which in the standard notation is just capital phi. So this simply becomes kappa equal to 3 psi dot plus 3 h phi in the zero shear gauge, this kappa. So now we want to compute compute equation 44, which is the Reichauer equation. So the equation 44 of Bardeen is kappa dot with laps equal to 1, 2h kappa is minus, I'll put a delta by a square, okay, because that is our, we are going to the standard notation, plus 3h dot alpha plus 4 pi g epsilon plus 3 pi. So if you recast this, now it is very simple to compute. We know what is kappa. We compute just kappa dot. We use the relation for h dot in terms of h and rho. We use the h dot equation in the background. And then we can write this part. So if we are working... Okay, let us assume also some more things. I'll be interested in particular, I want to do an application. I want to show some physics of what we'll get from this equation. So let us work with the situation where we have spatial curvature equal to 0 and the entropic perturbations are also 0. Okay, just for a moment. Then the derivation also becomes slightly easier. Okay, eventually, like, I want to show you, for example, when Neil talked about CDM or dust or radiation, this is what we are also assuming all the time. So if you use that, and if you just plug in all the equations, you solve this and you plug in it here, then what you get is an equation which is psi double dot plus 3h psi dot plus 2h dot psi plus 2h squared psi plus delta psi by a square equals 4 pi g by 3 delta rho 1 plus 3 c s square. So here we have used the fact that we are working with adiabatic perturbations, then entropic perturbations are 0. So this is a slightly, if you don't assume anything, if you don't work with a zero shear gauge, this is a lengthy calculation. If you assume this, the zero shear gauge, and if you also assume that, then
This is very simple to get in 2 or 3 steps. Now what you can do is you can do one more thing.
Yeah, I want to do one more thing here. I want to assume that this pi, this capital pi which we have, the sigma which we have is 0. So the anisotropic,
there is no anisotropic stress in the fluid.
This means from one of the equations which we derived yesterday, which was some derivatives here, and then psi minus phi equal to some derivatives acting on sigma.
If sigma is 0, psi is equal to phi. So we are also working with, let us work with that kind of matter,
that psi is phi. An isotropic stress equal to 0 implies our psi is equal to phi.
The two bodying potentials are equal. If you do that, and if you use the energy density constraint, the energy density equation which we derived, so use energy density constraint in this, okay, then you will get a final answer,
which in conformal time
is psi double prime
plus 3h 1 plus cs squared psi prime plus 2h prime plus h squared 1 plus ps squared psi minus of delta psi minus of cs squared delta. So this is the equation, this is the final equation in form of the gauge invariant variables which you will obtain from the evolution of the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Okay, this is some somewhat lengthy calculation if you don't assume any, if you don't make any assumptions, but one can get there. Okay. So now let us try to see some physics from here. So now you can do many things from here. For example, okay, so the other thing is that if I would not have put the entropy perturbation equal to 0, I can still go through the same derivation like this, but instead of 0, I would get this quantity equal to 4 pi g a squared p gamma. So actually this is a more general answer. So you can do this without putting entropy perturbation equal to 0. So the entropy perturbation, but this is 4 pi g a squared p gamma. Okay? So the entropy perturbation is 0, you get this equal to 0. So now I want to come to the conservation of this gauge invariant quantity r, which Lith introduced, and we can now see why it is conserved at large scale. So one way to see it is from this equation. Okay. So I gave you yesterday a derivation of how we can see that zeta, which Bardeen introduces, is conserved at largest scales. You can try to do the same derivation for the r which I gave you yesterday, and you will see it doesn't go through. And the reason is that this, the r which Lith introduced, is conserved under more assumptions than the zeta which Bardeen introduced. So they are different physical entities. Okay. So now I want to show that r is conserved. Okay. So let us do that. So if you look at almost all textbooks, then they define this zeta Lith, which is r in Bardeen in slightly different way, as this 2 by 3 1 plus w xi plus phi prime by h plus phi. That is, take it as a definition of a gauge invariant quantity. And this is gauge invariant
trivially because, as I have presented you, this is in the form of gauge invariant variables. And this can be derived from the Bardeen's, the expression in the Bardeen's paper, which he gives for R.
Okay? So, now let us compute psi L prime.
So, you see, that is the reason I gave you this equation, because if the anisotropic stress is 0, then psi is equal to phi. So I can rewrite this equation either in terms of psi or in phi. Okay, they are the same things. What I want to compute is psi L prime. What I want to compute is this zeta L prime. So if I want to do that, I will encounter psi prime and phi double prime. And I need this equation for that. So if you go through these steps, then you find that zeta L prime is 2 by 3H 1 plus W. And finally one gets, after few steps, after substituting things and so on here, that this is equal to 4 pi g a square by h square p gamma minus c s square k square, this is k square. And this k square comes from this delta. This delta is k square. K square by h square phi. You can erase this now. And then the last term we get is plus c by h square 1 plus 3w by 2h phi prime plus 3 c square minus w phi. So this is the final answer, which you will obtain if you compute psi L prime and use various equations which we have derived today and yesterday. Okay? So now let us first take the case. Let us stare at this equation and see under what assumptions we get psi L prime, we get psi L to be conserved at the super Hubble scales. Okay. So the first thing we need is we want to assume that the perturbations are adiabatic, because this is what we also assumed yesterday when we were looking at zeta introduced by Bardeen. So if perturbations are adiabatic, so that is gamma equal to 0. Okay? So this term goes away if perturbations are adiabatic. The second thing we want to assume is we are in the spatially flat universe, or the spatial curvature is very small. So the spatial curvature is very small, this term goes away, because this is multiplied by the spatial curvature C here. Okay? So we are just left with this term. So now this term is exactly analogous to what we did yesterday. This is a k square term. If you see, if k goes to 0, this term goes 0. Now psi L prime. And so again we see that psi L is conserved at the larger scales. The more sophisticated way to see it is now that it comes in a nice ratio, k square by h square. So we want to ask the question that we consider super Hubble, then we want to say C equal to 0. The third thing we want to ask is K by H is much, much smaller than 1. So this is the super Hubble, these are the super Hubble scales. So now let us look at this expression and this expression, just this term. Okay? So this term is linear in fluctuations. There is a psi term, there is a phi prime term, there is a phi term. There is no non-linear term in the perturbations. Okay? It is just first order expression. If we look at this term, just this term, this is already first order in perturbations. If k square by h square is very small, much smaller than 1, this is essentially of a higher order than this term. The term in the psi L prime is higher order than the terms in psi L. So if you're looking at the linear perturbations, you can ignore psi L prime completely. Okay? So for the scales k by h less than 0 or k by h much, much smaller than 1, psi L prime is 0. So that is the reason why this Litz R or psi L, which I have called, is 0, and that is conserved on the supernova scale. But you should notice what are the assumptions which have gone in. We didn't assume anything regarding the vanishing of the anisotropic stress when we were deriving the same thing for Bardeen zeta yesterday. Okay? We didn't make as many assumptions. But here we have to make more assumptions. So is it clear what we have to? Not clear? Little bit. Shall I repeat in some way? Okay, yeah. No, k is the wave mode, I'm sorry. So, yeah, it's a wave number. So when k is much smaller, sorry, this is not h, this is curly. This curly h. So this k is the wave number, it's inverse of the wavelength. So k by h much less than 1 means we are probing wavelengths which are much longer than the Hubble length. So that is why we are in the super Hubble scales. Okay? So this is the, if you look at some books, this is the nice way that they argue about why this Litz R is conserved quantity. But you can clearly see, you can compare yesterday's very simple calculation which we did in 3 lines and this calculation, and you can see which derivation requires more assumptions to prove that zeta is conserved. So certainly Bardeen zeta is conserved under less assumptions. Both require adiabatic perturbations, but you don't require an anisotropic stress to vanish in Bardeen's zeta. Yeah. Yeah, so I told you yesterday, right? So this R or this zeta is actually, so if you are in the co-moving gauge, so they have different interpretations, that's true. So our zeta of Bardeen was what? Zeta of Bardeen was phi, if I remember correctly, it was epsilon plus 3 E naught plus P naught. So if you're in the uniform density gauge, Bardeen zeta is the curvature perturbation, is phi. But this zeta, which we actually have from here, if you are in the, so this you can write. You can write this expression as, this. You can write this expression, this bracket, as something like 4 pi g a square 1 plus w rho b. You have to use the equation which we derived yesterday. What was that equation? Which came from the momentum constraint. This is the one part of the momentum constraint. So if you use this derivation, then this that equation, then this is proportional to the velocity. So we know that velocities are zero in the co-moving gauge. So in the co-moving gauge, this expression becomes phi, which is also true the way Bardeen defines Litz R. So Bardeen defines Litz R as, how does he define? He defines it as phi minus, phi plus h psi e naught plus p naught. They are equivalent expressions. I've just written in a different way. We know that in the co-moving gauge, the velocities are zero, so psi's contribution will be zero. So in the co-moving gauge, this will be the curvature perturbation. So they have different physical meanings in different gauges. So that's not surprising. Okay, so now I want to do another very quick calculation, just to show you the power of this equation. This is essentially everything. Like, now you just have to solve it, put your favorite matter inside it, and because you will have different h and h prime, and you will have a different pressure and entropy perturbation, just solve it, and the solutions are the answers which we see in the sky. Okay? So now let us do that for some very simple matter.
Neil has already done this in the synchronous gate, so I'm just highlighting you how it can be done without using any gate now.
Okay, so if you take matter, with which we are all made up of, almost, which has W equal to constant, that is the equation of state is constant, then first thing which you can prove, before that, if you take this as the thing, and if you write psi in terms of phi, just as a notation, I'm going to phi, because phi is equal to psi. So W equal to constant, C equal to 0, gamma equal to 0, pi equal to 0. This is our very simple universe. Dust, radiation, baryons, all do this. So if you do that, then our equation becomes 3H1 plus W, phi prime, plus K square, C square phi, equal to 0.
Okay? And now you can learn many things from here by solving this. So first thing which we can do is to solve this equation. We can define,
you can introduce a variable f, which is defined as some x nu of phi.
This is the definition,
where x is defined as k times eta, where eta is the conformal time. Okay?
So if you do that, then you will get an equation d square f by dx square plus 2 by x df by dx plus w minus mu plus 1 by x square f equal to 0.
And the solution of this equation, if you solve this equation, this will just give you Bessel functions. And this solution is if you write in terms of phi, you will just get phi equal to minus 3 nu squared. I'll explain you what is nu. Nu is essentially I should explain first what is nu. So nu, okay, so if you are in the conformal time, then the scale factor, if you solve the Friedmann equations, the scale factor is proportional to eta the power nu, the conformal time power nu, and nu, if you have constant equation of state, is 2 by 1 plus 3w. We are just solving. So we got this equation from here, assuming constant equation of state. Okay. Cs square disappears. The reason is if you have constant equation of state, then equation of state becomes equal to Cs square. You can prove it. Okay. You can take equation of state, p by rho, take w equal to p by rho as the... This is the fundamental equation which we have. Find W dot from here. Okay? And you will get an expression, something something times Cs square minus W. Okay? If W dot is 0, this something is not 0. This is 0, so Cs square will be equal to W. So that is why, while going from there to here, this W appears. This is in place of one of the Cs squares. Now we are just solving it. This is like, you can put it on Mathematica or your favorite software just like this, and it will just give you the same answer, which I'm going to write. I'm just telling you some of the steps which you can use. And then you get the solution, the final solution of our fluctuation for a given matter as some Bessel function. This is CSX plus, which will give you one growing mode and one decaying mode, which Neil has already talked about. That this J nu and N nu are related to the Bessel functions of the first kind and the Neumann functions. With J nu is the standard, pi by 2 is if you have some number. Essentially, like, it's the same thing. J nu is related to, this you can see in any handbook. This is our final result of solving all perturbation equations for the matter with which most of the universe is made up of. Okay? This is the final answer.
So now let us see what it tells us for dust. So if you have dust, so if you take dust, and dust is W equal to 0, this will give us nu equal to 2. And you can, actually you don't even have to solve using this because this equation becomes very simple. And you will get phi as a growing mode phi plus a decaying mode phi minus x to the power minus 5. Once you know phi from here, once you have solved for phi, you can get anything you want, because now we know the equations for delta dot, which we derived yesterday. We know the equation for velocity, perturbation. You can solve that. You can just plug in it there, and you can find delta dot. You can integrate delta dot. You can integrate V dot. You can do whatever. So this is the answer for dust. If you look at delta, then delta will come out to be minus 1 by 6. This is the perturbation in the energy density. This is the perturbation in the metric, minus x square phi. And similarly, you can find for velocity. And you can show that in this case, the delta actually will be proportional to eta square. And from the behavior of eta square, delta will be proportional to A. So the density contrast of dust dominated universe scales as scale factor. Yeah.
To go from the general equation to the omega equal constant equation, there is one term which is 2h pi plus h square 1 plus 3 c square.
Yeah, so that will go away. You will have to, this is not trivial at the moment. Like we can discuss after the class how one gets there. Maybe I can give some more hints. So similarly, you can do it for, I understand why you're confused. Actually, this equation can be written in a completely different way also. Okay, and then it is easier to get to this equation. But we can discuss it after the class. So, but this is true. That you will get this equation from the equation which we erased. This is one of the equations which you put one in that one of that forms, okay? Okay, so you can also do this same game for radiation. So the important thing is that for if you have a dust dominated universe, then phi it just is made up of like this, and the density contrast goes proportional to the scale factor. So did Neil talk about this in the synchronous gauge? No, this result, that the density one, energy density goes as scale factor. Okay, he must have mentioned, because Okay, so now we can do the same thing for radiation. I'm just giving you the outline. I'm not going to do this because I think you have done this in Neil's class. So if you do this for radiation, if you look at the Bessel function, you can look at two regimes, CSX much smaller than 1, CSX much greater than 1. And they will essentially correspond to the super Hubble modes and the sub Hubble modes from the definition of X. So this is like CS K eta, and eta is related to the Hubble parameter. In the conformal time, H is essentially 1 over eta, proportional to 1 over eta. H goes as 1 over eta in the conformal time. So this CSX much smaller than 1 and greater than 1 just corresponds to that. So if you do that for radiation, let us say W equals 1 by 3, we take CS, CSX much smaller than 1, then we will get phi going as phi plus
phi minus x to the power minus 3. So this is the decaying mode. It decays very fast. So phi is just constant, the metric perturbation. Okay? And outside, and if you find the delta, similarly here, then the delta will go as a square in the radiation dominated phase for the supernova modes. If you are at CS much greater than 1, this is the sub-Hubble mode. If you are in this regime, so this is in the super-Hubble mode for radiation, this is in the sub-Hubble modes, then phi is actually oscillatory, so it will be some phi plus x to the power minus 2 cos of CSX minus phi. This phi is 3.14159. This is not our pi in the notation. Okay? So if you look at phi, if you look at the plot of phi now versus log of CSX, you will see that it is constant first and then it goes like this. I think you must have done this in the synchronous sketch. Did you guys do? Did you do? Or?
We talked about it briefly.
Briefly, okay. But this is, but essentially it's the same thing. Like Neil derived it in the synchronous gauge equation. We are deriving in full generality. We get a Bessel function. We just have to look at the solutions of the Bessel function, the asymptotic behavior of the Bessel function now. And we get phi's behavior as this. If you look at delta, then the delta gives a very familiar behavior, which we also see in the power spectrum. It will go like this. So it will go as a square earlier, and then it will just keep on oscillating in the sub-Hubble modes. So this is essentially the heart of the power spectrum, which we see, which Neil discussed in the synchronous gauge. You can also do the velocity perturbation, and it will have very similar. Sorry, this is a big slope. This should go like this. Okay, so if there are any questions on this part, please ask. Then I'm going to do the last part of this course. Completely different thing. So what we have learned today is that we derived a fundamental equation, which we had already derived a week back, the kappa dot equation. We wrote that kappa dot equation for simple matter, but we are all made up of that matter. We took entropy perturbations to be zero. We took anisotropic stress to be zero. And then two body potentials are equal. From the kappa dot equation, we can write this equation. Then we further assume that W is constant. Then we are left to a very simple equation, which is like this. This equation can be solved. We get Bessel functions. Put your favorite value of W inside. Okay? We put W equal to 0 and W equal to 1 by 3. For W equal to 0, you don't even have to go through this calculation. For W equal to 1 by 3, you can analyze the asymptotic behavior of Bessel functions in two regimes, super-Hubble modes, sub-Hubble modes. And we learn a lot how the metric perturbations and the matter perturbations will behave in the super-Hubble modes and the sub-Hubble modes. Okay? Okay, so now I'm going to go back to something which I promised I will do, but I didn't do, which is about the residual gauge fields. So you see, in this calculation today, what we did, we started with the zero shear gauge, but that was just for simplicity to get to the final equation. This is completely independent of any gauge. Once you write in terms of the fully gauge invariant variables, you can forget how you got this equation. That was just to get to this equation, the last equation. If you don't assume that, which we didn't assume for some of the equations done yesterday, then this equation is actually quite difficult to derive. It's very messy, and you have to do lots of permutations of different equations. If you assume zero shear gauge, you don't have to worry about chi and chi dots. So that is why it becomes easier. Okay, so let us go towards conclusion. So I mentioned to you various gauges. So you have thoroughly learned about synchronous gauge in various lectures.
And the synchronous gauge was essentially, I will not go through the details of different gauges. I will just show you the residual freedom. Okay.
So synchronous gauge by definition is alpha equal to 0. The perturbation in lapse is 0 and perturbation in shift is 0.
Alpha is 0.
Did I give any tutorial or homework on proving something on these? The residual freedom? Okay.
So this we have done already in the class. And then if we took n not equal to 1,
then we know that alpha prime, if you take alpha prime, then we get alpha minus t dot, and then beta tilde is beta plus lambda dot minus t by a square.
And one of the problems with this gauge is that there are two residual freedoms.
So let us say we start with some coordinates in which our fluctuations are alpha and beta, and we go into the synchronous gauge where alpha and beta are 0. So we go to synchronous gauge, and in this gauge we have like alpha tilde and beta tilde are 0. So we just solve these, and when we solve this, we get t dot equal to alpha and lambda dot equal to beta minus t by a square.
I think we have done this before.
And then you will get two constants of integration which are completely arbitrary.
So the synchronous gauge has two degrees of freedom which are still left to be fixed.
So that is why it is not a good gauge, in the sense that sometimes in some physical situations it can happen that these residual degrees of freedom can themselves be very large, and they may completely mask the actual physical fluctuations. Okay?
So that is one thing. The second thing is let us go to comoving gauge, which is slightly better. So in the comoving gauge, we know that we are in the frame in which fluid is at rest. So ui is 0. And then we have to fix the time slicing. So this fixes the space slicing, and this fixes the time slicing. There are two conditions, g naught I equal to 0, and this translates to psi equal to 0 and beta equal to 0. Okay, so now we can again recall that our psi tilde was psi plus e naught plus p naught t. This is the gauge transformation property which we derived, and our beta tilde is beta plus lambda dot minus t by a square. So if we fix this gauge, comoving gauge, and if you put psi tilde and beta tilde as 0 and solve for psi and beta, then there is no arbitrary freedom left in the fixing the clocks, because your t is just psi by e naught plus p naught. Okay, so this freedom which was there to synchronize your clocks, or where you put your time coordinate, goes away here. It is completely fixed by the metric. metric perturbation. There is no arbitrary constant left here. But if you do it for, but you see, like, there is a lambda dot here, so that is not going to go away. So lambda dot is going to be minus beta plus t by a square, and that gives you one constant. So you will get, okay, so we can put t here, so we'll get minus beta plus psi by e naught plus p naught a square, and then when we integrate it, we'll get a lambda, which is minus of beta dt plus psi of e naught plus p naught a square dt plus a constant c1, which is an arbitrary constant. So there is, if you go to the co-moving gauge, there is one residual degree of freedom. In the synchronous gauge, there were two residual degrees of freedom. So now we can go to the last gauge, which is our Newtonian gauge. So in the Newtonian gauge, the shear is zero, and this gauge is defined as gamma equal to zero and beta equal to zero. So there is no perturbation in shift, and there is no gamma perturbation. So this is expansion is isotropic in this gauge. And now we can look at what was chi. So we had a relation for chi tilde. We had chi minus of n naught t. If you put chi tilde equal to 0, it just gives you t. So if you put chi tilde 0, it just gives you t equal to chi by n naught. And we also had gamma tilde equal to gamma minus lambda, which we had derived. And if you put gamma tilde equal to 0, then it just gives lambda equal to gamma. So there is no arbitrary constant left, which we need to fix. So the Newtonian gauge, in which phi h is equal to phi and phi a, in which phi h is equal to phi, which is equal to minus of this Mukhanov of psi, and phi a is equal to alpha, which is equal to capital phi of Mukhanov. There is no freedom left. So this is actually a completely fixed gauge. And that is why it is ideal for many purposes. Okay? So I think I will stop here. And if you have any questions, let us discuss them. Or if you want to do something, if you want that something should be done, let us do that now. Otherwise, I think this is enough for the course. You have any questions? Let us discuss the questions. You must have many questions from the course, starting from the first lecture, in which we made a minus sign mistake. So why don't you go through your notes and see if you didn't understand some particular point, then let us discuss it. Or any small derivation which you think we should, or if you want, like, we can do, David, if you want, we can see that psi double prime derivation now in detail. If there is a majority, not a minority, to see it. So this answers your questions, right? That why in the Newtonian gauge there is no freedom left. Okay, you can do the same exercise for other gauges. Okay. So there are no questions? Yeah. Good.
Why the Newtonian gauge is not possible?
That is a definition. Oh, just wait. Maybe I made a mistake. No, the Newtonian gauge beta is equal to zero because it is essentially, well, first of all, it's a definition of the Newtonian gauge. Secondly, it's a zero shear gauge.
and we know the relation of chi with beta. So if you ask chi equal to 0, there is a gamma and beta there. Since gamma and beta are independent perturbations, we require both of them to be 0. Newtonian gauge by definition is the gauge in which expansion is isotropic. If you want expansion to be isotropic, you will have to put beta equal to 0. So then can I ask questions or I'm not allowed? Okay, so there is one homework which is to be done, which will be essentially from Neil's lectures. I will send you David a mail today. What is that homework? It is very straightforward. So, but have you guys done previous two homeworks or most of you have done? Okay, very nice. So do you think homeworks should have been easier or they were adventurous and exhausting?
Exhausting.
Yeah, most of these derivations were. Yeah, I think that was deliberate because I wanted that you should also do some, you should make your hands dirty at least once in the course. Okay, then I think we should stop. Like, you guys are not asking any questions. Either you have understood everything or I have failed.
There is one question.
Okay.
So this is off topic. Is there like an easy way to see that the stress energy tensor has to be bilinear? Like, I asked Professor Turek, and he just said that, you know, it comes, like, you go from the definition using Noether's theorem, then it just comes out. But
you mean why it is a perfect fluid?
No. Why is this? So the stress energy tensor
has a particular form. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you put in one index the four velocity of an observer, and the other index you get out the four momentum density of the fluid. And yeah, why is that? Why is it a tensor?
Why is it a tensor?
Why isn't it like nonlinear?
Actually, I think I don't understand your question fully. So, what is the question? So, if you take a homogeneous isotropic background...
So, you have a machine where you stick in the four velocity of an observer, and you get out a four momentum density, which is the four momentum density of whatever matter is in your space-time.
It's a component of the tensor, T0. This Ji is a vector, right? Which you're talking about the four momentum density.
Yeah.
So
the stress energy tensor is a machine which takes in a four vector and spits out another four vector. Like, it takes in the four velocity of the observer and spits out the
spin
density.
Or the energy density
observed by that observer.
Yeah.
So why is that a linear map? Why is that a linear map?
Why is that a linear map? I see. Well, I don't know offhand. Like, I have to think about it. So your question is that why, suppose you take a team union. Maybe like you are saying, like, if you take a T mu nu and you contract with U mu U nu. Because we don't contract with one velocity, right?
Well, what would it mean that you're contracting with two velocities?
Well, I just want to look at, for example, the way we have defined T naught naught, or you can do T naught naught, which was rho. Okay? So you can start with, So you can start with T mu nu and you can contract. It depends what you want to project on. You want to project on the T00 part or the Tij part.
Okay, so this is plugging in two copies of the observer's four velocity and getting the density, the energy density that the observer serves. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's like a quadratic. You're just treating it as a quadratic form, essentially, rather than...
I think both of us are not saying the same thing and neither of us is exactly right. So we start with some T mu nu, right? Which is rho plus B U mu U nu. This is the definition, which comes from the geometry, essentially. If you assume a homogeneous isotropic universe, this is the most general tensor you can write.
No, I'm asking why is it a tensor? Like, well, I don't care about like the specific. There are many possible forms of T mu nu, right?
But there is only one form. This is a more general form you can write on a homogeneous isotropic background.
You cannot write for a perfect fluid, like under some assumptions.
Maybe there's like a disconnect here. Well, how about this? Is it conceivable to have matter, like a form of matter, for which the stress energy tensor is nonlinear? Like it's not a tensor?
That's a good question. So you're saying, can you have in the T-mu-nu nonlinear terms, let us say rho or P, and whether it is compatible with the homogeneous isotropic background?
No, whether it's compatible with like the properties of matter, like
you see, the matter cannot be defined without you define the background. Like matter lives on something, so you have to give me a metric.
Okay, let's do flat space then.
Yeah, but what flat? Flat cosmological space time.
Like Minkowski space time.
On Minkowski space time, I don't even know whether such a matter will.
Like it's not. What I'm asking is not like complicated. It's like. You're in Minkowski space-time, which approximately, which just means that you're small enough and stars are far enough away.
Yeah, okay, so this is not Minkowski. So our universe is not a Minkowski space-time. There's a scale factor. So let us all
right,
take
but
that.
But it doesn't matter. We can always like make our lab small enough that the universe is essentially Minkowski. Yes?
You can look at a hypersurface, yes.
Yes.
Okay, good.
So I like sit there like stationary and I use like my density meter or whatever to measure the energy density.
Okay, so now,
or the momentum density.
Yeah, if you have assumed now the properties of space, okay, and because your matter can also be a pointer in the space to observe the properties of the space, spatial geometry, then in this T-mu-nu, which you write, you cannot have nonlinear terms.
Okay.
Okay, if you assume the properties of space that it is homogeneous and isotropic, then you cannot write nonlinear terms in this T-mu-nu. That is the answer.
Okay.
If you write, then I don't think you'll be able to satisfy G-mu-nu equal to T-mu-nu.
Okay.
You see, okay. Because you see, as we discussed in the very first lecture, you can take hypersurface. The hypersurface is given to you with some energy density, with some metric and so on. You define some shift and lapse, the way you are defining. But you have to satisfy the Einstein constraints.
No, you don't. I'm not talking about like, this is what I have in mind. Like, you have, like, some, how do I say this? And, like, imagine, like, you have matter, right? And you just have some machine which measures, like, it's a cube, right? Which means it's sort of a flat, like, a flat sheet in space-time. And it measures, like, how much moment, like, how much form momentum is piercing it at one moment. So you, like, click a button, and it gives you a number, which is an amount of form momentum. Right.
But that number, my claim is that number depends on what geometry you assume in which this machine is.
It doesn't depend on anything. It depends on physics. It depends on, like, it's an experiment. We're just...
No, but you have already, once you have taken this lab, you have already assumed where this lab is located, right? You have a homogeneous isotropic universe given to you.
Well, yes, I'm assuming that it's approximately Minkowski, so yes.
Okay, so once you do that, then you can only write linear terms.
Because of Einstein's equation, or
because of the constraints you have to satisfy on your.
And what are the constraints?
Essentially, they come from Einstein equations.
Right. I'm not. So Einstein's equation is like.
Okay.
Like,
okay. So to answer your question, if you don't assume any physical laws,
yes,
then you can write anything.
Okay.
No. There's nothing to. This is serious. Like, you are completely right.
Okay.
You maybe the Einstein equations are not correct. So. You're asking a very good question. That
so if I,
essentially, you are if you assume that in the action you start with for your theory, if there are other terms, right, such that basically you can ask a reverse question. I want to put this matter. What is the theory of my geometry? You can put arbitrary T mu nu as you want to put. You can say I want to start with a nonlinear T mu nu in my Minkowski background. And I want to write a theory of gravity which is compatible with this T-mu-nu. Then my claim is you will not get Einstein's theory. You will get something more general than that.
No. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I should talk about this after. I don't think this is the question I'm asking.
Okay. Then maybe let us talk about it later. Yeah. But it's a good question. So, but the point is that if you take T-mu-nu, if you assume Minkowski, the way I quote-unquote, I understand your Minkowski, which is homogeneous and isotropic,
then the team union cannot have nonlinear terms. And the reason is that you will have to, if you assume general relativity to be true.
Like
essentially, homogeneity and isotropy itself will dictate you that team union will have these terms.
Like you keep talking about Einstein's equation. I think perhaps the confusion, like, let's assume we're in a regime where the matter density is so small that it does not affect the geometry. So no matter what.
Okay, so if you so this is just test particles.
Yes.
Yeah. So test particles can have any form of team union. And their team union is never going to back react on geometry or anything.
Uh-huh.
So you can write anything. Then you are completely right. So but then we are not talking about this. This is a perfect fluid. This is a matter which back reacts on geometry. And on which geometry back reacts.
Okay, so for like if I'm understanding correctly that if you have like this fluid of test particles or whatever, you can have this matter can have the property that, you know, if I'm moving at 1 meter per second, the four velocity is like this.
Yeah.
And then if I boost, so I'm now moving at 2 meters per second, same direction, the four velocity changes nonlinearly with my boost.
Okay, but these are test particles. Or what is this? Does this matter react on geometry or?
No.
Yeah, I think then you can do anything,
okay.
Probably. But let us, I think like maybe there is a disconnect in our.
Yeah.
Straight line, so let's talk about it.
Yeah.
You have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to, I know you've commented on this before, but I'm curious why, again, when we're doing perturbation theory, we also seem to be doing, like, perturbation gauge transformation theory. Like, we never consider general gauge transformation. Is that just because we don't know how to do it, or is there a good reason? Because, like, it would seem like doing perturbation theory, you should still be able to do a completely arbitrary gauge transformation and have everything stay.
So first of all, we are doing linear perturbation theory. Okay, so and our perturbations are infinitesimally small. So, well, you can do arbitrary gauge transformations, but it's like killing a groundnut with a road roller or something. It's not needed for us. So we want to look at infinitesimal coordinate transformations only, because otherwise we don't want that our knowledge about the linear perturbations goes away completely. So that is one reason. Second reason is that it is more complicated and beyond the scope of this course. If you do nonlinear perturbation theory, you have to be very much careful with the gauge transformations. You have any questions? You ask most questions.
If you only consider the isentropic condition, why would only consider the rank 2 energy momentum tensor?
That's a very good question. So
for
the reason, very simple intuitive reason is because our geometry is described by rank 2.
I mean, rank 2 is to the perfect field. But can we consider like some solid, some
you can.
Like
in principle. Okay, so you are saying why can't we write an equation which, or why Einstein didn't try something like this? G mean equal to 8 pi G, some constant, let us call J, mu alpha, mu beta, contracted with something, right? Something here. You can do that, but my guess is that if you do that and if it describes the properties of matter in homogeneous isotropic background, you'll be actually looking at team union again. That is a quick way to see. The second thing is simplicity. If something is described by a second rank tensor here, I'll put a second rank tensor here. Anyway, I'll have to contract, right, to match the indices. So why should I start with a fourth rank tensor and then contract? Why don't I call my second rank tensor as the one describing matter? It's essentially the same thing. I cannot balance a second rank equation, second rank tensor here on the left hand side with a fourth rank tensor there. I'll have to contract two indices anyway. But maybe what you want to ask is that why geometry is described by Riemann curvature, which is fourth rank tensor, and matter is described by a two rank tensor. So I think like I haven't ever thought about this question, but I think like what you can do is you can try to write an analog of the Riemann curvature force even matter. But what will actually turn out in Einstein or these dynamical equations, even if they are not Einsteinian, is a second rank tensor of something like this form. So I think Einstein must have played with this, perhaps, this idea, what you are asking, before getting to Team Union.
I have a question about Monk theory. Does it exist a full general relativistic version of Monk theory?
Yeah. I don't know, man. I'm really not an expert on. I'm not even expert on cosmological perturbations, so I really don't know the answer to that. I think that there is like recently there are relativistic Monk theories, a la Bekenstein and John Moffat works on some of that.
Because I heard that they had difficulties with perturbation theory.
There are difficulties with perturbation theory even in standard cosmology.
Yes.
So
there is difficulties to match the
data. Yeah, but I think like we should stop.
Yes.
I should switch on the mic. No.
So
I think like one thing which has to be very careful, one has to be very careful, is that especially cosmology is not a very democratic field. It's actually a very democratic field because the majority counts. So if there is a minority which doesn't agree on something or which has a different alternative viewpoint, they are just killed. So you should certainly, when you find time, there is a very nice book by Hoyle and Nalikar, Different Approach to Cosmology. Well, some of the parts are not very clear and maybe not also right, but at least like the introduction and the way they have written the book is very nice, that it tells you about sometimes why theories such as like Mon, like even if it is fine and if it assumes similar amount of things and passes through the same tests of like, which is a simpler theory, they will not be pursued.
Let's thank the lecturer.
Okay.